So this is John Culp again in Louisiana, and I've got somebody special here. It's my dad. Hey, Dad.
Hi.
He's got his finger in his mouth right now.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I thought it'd be fun to talk to him because he's the person that I know who's been into computers the longest of anybody I know, probably. You said you were building computer boards back in the 1960s?
Well, no, I worked at the Educational Testing Service at Florida State University when I was a freshman. And that would be in the spring of 62. And I had to hand wire the boards for correcting tests, which were the correct answers, and then the algorithm for counting the grades and everything. So that was my first experience with any kind of computer thing, and it wasn't like a guy that was when they did the original computers and they programmed in zeros and ones. You know, it didn't have any programming involved in it. And then I took Fortran 2, which was a brand new language back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an IBM 7094 in the physics department that we used for our nuclear accelerator, and they would allow us one run a day. And so you had to punch cards and turn it in. If you had a key punch error, you lost a day. And you had to learn to bench check your programs and run through the logic, because it's not like today where it doesn't work. You just make a change on the terminal and you run it again, and everything's interactive. And here we'd have an assignment due each week, and you may only get five or six runs total, and it's got to be right. So you learn to be careful. And I got so that when I program something, I expect it to run the first time. I don't expect that it may be perfect, but I expect it to run. You know, I don't think very many younger programmers who haven't been through that kind of training care. You know, they'll let the compiler debug their program for them.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they get all their key punch errors or their coding errors, syntax errors, and all that stuff.
The stray missing semicolon or curly bracer.
Yeah, just let it do it. You know.
Yeah, I could see that. You know, I've been shell scripting for a while now, and at first I had errors all the time, but I've gotten to the point now where I generally expect things to work.
Sure.
At first, but it's just because of some experience. I want to go back to what you were saying about the testing thing. So you had to wire a board as a sort of a key? Is it like a...
You had a grid that matched the grid on the electronic scoring thing.
Okay.
And then you would plug the grid, a wire, into a board that matched that grid, and then plug it into another board that matched that the test would run against, and you'd plug it in for the correct answers.
So, okay.
So If you plugged it in the wrong place, then they got the test scored wrong.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the earliest computer I can remember, this is, of course, long before I was born, when you were doing this stuff. The earliest computer work I remember you doing was in the early 80s, when gradually boxes full of binders began to arrive at the house. And in these binders, I suppose, were just manuals on programming languages and what was all that stuff?
I got a first computer I actually owned was, I guess it was a Heath brand, 4.77 megahertz computer, 8086, I guess, and it was a lot of RAM. It had 640 megabytes, which at that time...
It can't possibly have been 640 megs back then.
Well, maybe it was
kilobytes. That computer we were just looking at out in the office only had 384 megs.
Okay, well, it was 640 kilobytes.
Okay.
And, it's 10 times as much as one of those little trash 80s.
Trash 80s, yeah.
Let's see. Or Commodore 64s.
Yeah, I remember my friend Mark that I skated with had a C64.
Yeah. I got with it a Fortran compiler and a COBOL compiler, and it may have had some accounting kind of stuff, or I don't know, I didn't use it. I remember I was afraid that they were going to make me teach COBOL.
Oh, at AFIT?
Lipscomb.
Okay.
So I didn't, I told them I knew how to program, but I didn't tell them I knew how to program COBOL.
Okay.
The COBOL compiler then required 5 passes to do one compile.
Hmm.
It was a monster. And Fortran was very nice. It was a pretty fast compiler.
So what kind of programs were you writing? What were you trying to do with these things?
Well, depends on how far back you want to go. I'm a statistician. I was writing programs primarily for data analysis, or I wrote programs that would do what people would do with Excel and stuff, because I preferred to run my own programs than to use Excel.
Was Excel around in the early 80s?
Something like it probably was.
There were spreadsheet applications back then, okay.
Back in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, right after you were born, I was doing computer support for our nuclear war plan.
Oh, how about that?
And computed the damage as nukes hit targets.
Yikes, Dad.
And compounded the damage, And so I had a program that ran I think it would norm this was on an IBM 360, it would take an hour to run to compute the damages.
Should mention that my dad was in the Air Force for 20 years. So I'm assuming it was in this capacity that they were asking you to do these kinds of things.
Yeah. After I came back from my flying tour in Vietnam, I did that.
So somewhere along the way in there, you also got involved with the Heath Kit building things.
Yeah.
So the first question then is, how in the world did you ever convince my mom that it was a good idea for you to start getting these packages and building things and having parts all over the house?
I didn't ask her. They just started arriving.
And I don't remember what sort of reaction she had to that.
Didn't bother her a bit.
Okay, well, boy, she's a saint, isn't she?
she's a very patient woman.
So what is Heathkit? For anybody who's not familiar, what was Heathkit?
Oh, it was a electronics kit. You can make radios. I made an oscilloscope.
I remember that well.
They would send you all the parts. You'd get all the resistors and the capacitors and a circuit board that had nothing on it, and instructions on how to place the things, and you'd follow step by step and build your circuit board. And if you were lucky, it would run. And if you weren't, it didn't. It was an expensive way to make a TV set,
yes,
or something. And remember, I did make a TV.
I remember. You know. We watched it for years, but I also seem to recall that you had to send it.
Oh yeah, I had a lot of trouble with
that. For troubleshooting.
Yeah, and it turns out that it took them almost a year to fix it. I had done everything according to the way it was supposed to be. All the checks worked. It just didn't run. And they never would say what they did to get it to run. I paid the $75 or something like that for the they had a flat fee. If your kit didn't run, you pay this much and they would fix it. Yeah. Well, I don't know what they did. And they were very moot about it, but
there must have been something embarrassing to them.
Well, I hope so. It wasn't embarrassing to me.
I mean, if you had done something really dumb, it seems like they would have told you.
Possibly. You know, they're still in the business of trying to sell stuff.
They want
to
sell
kits. They're not anymore. They're bankrupt. I mean, they went out of business.
Yeah, I remember looking at those catalogs. In fact, for the show notes for this episode, I'll probably put a link to one of the old catalogs. NY Bill up in New York sent me a while back a link to PDFs of some of these old Heathkit catalogs, and man, did it bring back memories. I remember looking at those things.
But my oscilloscope worked perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And
I remember the little meter that you made. And
yeah, I still use it.
Yeah,
it's a volt-ohm meter.
Mm-hmm.
And
what else was there? It seemed like it was a progressively more difficult things building up to.
I was taking a class on correspondence course on TV repair.
Oh,
that's what
I
did.
That.
Yeah, and so that's where all of this stuff came. I have a dot matrix generator that you can put in the back of a TV and generate the things, and then adjust the stuff.
The things you learn 30 years later.
Yeah, but I just thought it would be fun to do.
Yeah, well, you've always been a do-it-yourself guy, way back to when you were a new married guy and couldn't afford to pay somebody to fix your car.
Oh, yeah.
Going to the base workshop and just getting into it.
Yeah, we had a hobby shop that was very nice. You know? yeah. I mean, we didn't get paid very much. And so the hobby shop made a big difference. I remember right after I got my 64 Volkswagen, I took it for a 6-month checkup or 6,000-mile checkup or something, and it took half a month's pay.
Oh.
And I said, I can't do this, man. You know, I mean, I paid it, but so I said, next time I need an oil change, I'm going to the base hobby shop. And that's what I did, and I went in and told this guy running it. I said, I don't know a thing about it, but I can't afford these prices anymore. And he said, well, here's what you do. And that's where I started learning.
Awesome. Yeah. Many fond memories of standing around waiting to hand you a tool or something like that while you're under a car.
Or a bus.
Or a bus, yeah. During the 80s, it was, I guess, when did you get that Heath computer? That would have been about 1982 or 83, right?
I actually got it probably, it may have been as late as early 84.
Okay.
But it couldn't have been earlier than 83.
Right. And then I remember, here's one that it'll make you smile, I bet. So I remember many times during my teenage years where I would say, oh boy, I sure need to call Todd right now. I need to call Mike or something. And I'd pick up the phone to call him, and I hear this
Yeah.
Quickly followed by, from the other side of the house, no! Yeah. What in the world were you doing online all that time?
Well, you know, we only had a 300 baud connection to the school.
Right.
And so I was either transferring files or doing some other kind of work at night.
Such as, I mean, like what? I mean, what were you doing?
Oh, Lord, I don't know.
Because the internet, as we know it now, wasn't even a glimmer in the eye of
Albert Gore.
Yeah, right.
Al Gore hadn't thought of it yet.
Exactly. So, did you just use it to get into the library catalog or transfer files? I mean, yeah,
sometimes I'd be running SPSS or some other statistical package.
Okay.
And transferring data back and forth and letting it run on the server, then downloading the results.
I see.
Did that quite a bit.
So you were just using it as kind of a remote terminal?
Yeah, that's about all you could do is a remote terminal. Yeah.
So. It wasn't too awful long after that. Maybe, I must have been in college when you gave me that Heath computer, because you got something better. And I remember the very first time I ever connected to an outside computer, it was when I was in Chattanooga. I logged into our library catalog, and man, it took a long time, but it was amazing to be able to get the library catalog from my apartment by, like, through the phone lines.
It was faster than getting in your car and driving to school.
It was. Now, if I had had to do a whole lot of it, it would have been faster to go to school.
Yeah.
But if I just need to check one thing.
Sure.
It was definitely faster that way.
I mean, it was a computer we were just working on, or trying to work on, mm-hmm. You know. A Pentium 3. Sitting there forever trying to get it just to boot.
Right.
And
that's a powerhouse compared to what I was using.
Sure, yeah.
Let's see. So you were what? Professor of mathematics for a while, chair of the math department, mm-hmm. and eventually moved all the way up to be vice president of information technology.
Yeah.
Is that the title at Lipscomb?
Not quite, but it's close enough.
Yeah. Essentially. And, so what kind of things do you have to do at a university as a VP of InfoTech? Is that more of a...
Whatever the president wants you to do.
Is that a management thing, or do you get to do anything technical and fun?
A little bit of technical, but mostly management. You know? I mean... I was responsible for all of the telephones. Well, we only had 5,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know. the computers. Remember, I had K-12 in a university.
I didn't know you had K-12 under you also.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And we had to provide the computer support for them,
mm-hmm.
you see, on basically three campuses, although two were contiguous. And it's sort of like running a telephone system with a computer system for a town of 5,000. You know. Had to worry about all the administrative software, plus the softwares to support the academics. And every professor thought that the one little package that he wanted was the best package and the most important package, regardless of how much money it cost. And so you have to be able to tell people you can't have it and be the bad guy, you know. But as much as possible, you try to support everybody and ensure that what they want to do in their classroom, they're able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, try to enforce some kind of standards so that your limited number of technicians aren't breaking their backs over something for one person and letting a dozen people go unserved. See, so I mean, it's a balancing act. I was fortunate enough to have highly talented and dedicated people working for me. I never had serious problems of people not doing their jobs. You had a bigger problem of telling people, you know, really you need to go home and get some sleep.
Yeah, I think nerds in general have a habit, when there's a problem that's bugging them, they just keep pounding away at it until they can fix it.
Well, we would call coffee, Cokes, cookies, and all that, network supplies.
Network supplies.
Because that's like what that. Kept our network going in the middle of the night.
Exactly. That's pretty funny. Yeah. So what have you been doing since that? You've retired from that job, but you still, seems like you're always tinkering with some kind of code, programming this or that.
Well, you know, I wrote that program that does statistical auditing, sets up a design and takes a sample and then gives the results for a statistical audit of sales and use tax. Mm-hmm. for states, and 8 states use that. I've resisted writing in C# or C++. They're the languages of choice now. Mm-hmm. But I settled on Visual Basic because that was, believe it or not, purely because it was the one that was closest to Fortran.
Hmm. Okay.
And I started to write in Fortran for the GUI interface, and at the time it was so klutzy that that's why I chose to use the Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And it's a large program, you know. I don't know if I'd even breaking it up into dynamic link libraries and things and putting in pieces to it, it's still 50,000 lines of code. Hmm. So
if you were starting fresh right now, do you think you would start with some other programming language?
I'd do probably C# today.
Okay.
Simply because that's the language of choice. You know, that we did the Y2K thing, and there was a joke going around at the time that a COBOL programmer got really tired of the Y2K thing, so he had these people freezing, and with the idea that they would wake him up after Y2K, and they forgot about it, and he got woke up in 99-97, and they woke him up and said, "We understand you know COBOL," because they had a Y10K problem.
Oh dear.
There's a huge amount of legacy code around in COBOL and Visual Basic.
Mm-hmm.
And the banking industry especially has a huge amount of COBOL. And I think it's going to be around for years to come.
Are there still people learning this now, or are they learning it just on the fly because they have to solve a problem? Or
Most people are learning it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't think any colleges are teaching COBOL anymore. But I met one of our graduates a couple of years ago, and she says, you know, I hate to admit it, but all I do is write COBOL all day long.
No way.
I mean, she says, she's working for a big bank, and she's maintaining legacy code.
Oh, boy.
And there's a huge amount of it.
I guess there would be, I mean, if you were inclined to do that kind of work, you could probably find plenty of work helping people with their COBOL code, I suppose.
Yeah. I think a COBOL programmer who's willing to get into the nuts and bolts and really maintain some of that sophisticated legacy code would never go hungry. They may go crazy, but yeah, they wouldn't go hungry, you know.
Yeah. You know, I've never done any kind of compiled language. I'm not a programmer, you know. My PhD is in historical musicology, but I've gotten real nerdy over the last few years, and I do scripting. And so I mm-hmm. suppose if I were, the one language I'd like to know much better would be Python.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it seems so flexible. You can write stuff that works perfectly on Windows, Mac, mm-hmm. and Linux.
Yeah.
And but it's, you know, it's a high level, you know, mm-hmm. language. It doesn't run as fast as the compiled things, but it seems like the kind of thing that would work well for me. I know Jezra does a number of things in Python, and
it's interpreted, isn't it? It's not compiled.
Right. It's a scripting language.
Yeah.
And I've actually done a few little things in Python, but they've only been projects where I was just trying to kind of learn how it worked, and I was rewriting something that I had already done as a Bash script just trying to make Python do it. And I feel like I'm not, by doing it that way, I'm not really taking advantage of what Python could do. I don't really know what I've never taken any courses, any of these things. But.
Well, you never do all the capabilities of a language when what you're doing is making it act like another language.
Exactly.
You see. And but I don't do near what is capable in the .NET framework. Now, it's virtually indistinguishable between Visual Basic and C#. And I can write C#, and I can read it. There's only one or two instructions that are not common.
Mm-hmm.
And in another revision of the Microsoft Visual Studio, they'll probably be indistinguishable. The Visual Basic people will complain that you're making it look too much like C#, and the C# people saying, "What are you messing with Visual Basic stuff for?" But then there's F# out, and there's a bunch of other languages.
What in the world, F#?
Yeah, and I think you pay your nickel and you take your chances.
That's a perfect fourth above C#.
Yes. Yeah, that's probably the way they think of it.
Or a perfect fifth below.
Yeah.
It depends on which way you want to go.
So, I don't know what. I've never done anything with it, but if you go search Google for F#, you'll find people writing stuff in that language.
So does it, the idea of writing web applications interest you at all?
Things? I hate it.
Oh, you hate it?
I hate writing webs. I wrote the website for the our Lyons district,
mm-hmm,
a few years ago. And one of the happiest days of my life was when I found a guy who would take it over. And I wrote the website, when I had my business. And
were you talking about just HTML code or PHP?
I wrote some HTML, but I wrote mostly in ASP.
Oh, okay. That's another Microsoft thing?
Yeah, Active Server Pages.
Okay.
And
I don't think I've ever seen anything of it. Yeah, that's a little different than a web application, though.
This had a lot of compiled web behind code.
Oh, okay.
To make things work.
Cool. Yeah, I don't know how to do any of that either.
Well, you're blessed.
Yeah. I just know how to do scripting. That's pretty much it. But I love scripting.
Well, good.
It's really fun.
Because it's very useful. I mean, you've done a lot of things with it. And you certainly have gotten your money's worth out of Lily Ponds and doing those things.
So what kind of projects do you want to do? Are there things that just interest you that you want to do, or do you just write new projects when somebody hires you to do it?
I haven't been paid for a long time. If I find something that I think needs to get done, then I will try to write a program to do it. Right now, I'm in the Lions Club, and I wrote an application that allows us to keep a database of the people who receive glasses from us or hearing aids and stuff. Because we had some problems with people trying to game the system and get more than they should, more frequently than they should. And we have two clubs in Tullahoma, so they'd go back and forth and stuff. But I put that on a, put the database on a server, and you can connect through to my server and synchronize the database with your laptop. And so you can call up a person, and then when you've finished, if you provide a service to them, you can synchronize again. So if they go to the other club, they can look at it and say, "Hey, we just got, the other club just got you a pair of glasses." You see, that kind of thing. And I do, I wrote a program to hack into some commercial software that we bought
at
church. They advertised saying that they would do a report. You tell them the report they want, and for $150, they'll write that report. So I sent them the requirements. This is what we want. And they came back and said, well, we're too busy. We're not going to do it.
What?
It hacked me off so mad.
I'll tell you,
I just paid $600 or whatever for the software. You say, and it's very good software. So I kept on their case until finally they gave me enough information about the database that I could figure out that it was really a DBase database.
Okay.
And so I got hold of, to make sure, I bought a thing that would allow you to look at DBase databases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you could even change the stuff, but it wasn't DBase. And found out where the data was that I wanted. And so now what I do is, it's actually a Fox Pro kind of thing. And I got the Fox Pro driver. And I go in and I copy their database, those tables. I don't modify them, I just copy them. And then I put them in SQLite and I run the things and I print, do the report that I want and then delete the file, mm-hmm. See, that I created. So what they did is they got me mad.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me over a year to figure out what the database was, but I got the program written. And and then I went on their community site and I said, okay, all you guys, if you want this program, contact me and I'll send it to you.
Nice. Way to share. That's the open source spirit right
sure.
there.
Sure. Well, crud. Come on. I mean, what you had to do is keep track of, this was a church attendance program, and you keep track of the last time people attended worship.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would print out a column for the people who had missed that week, or had missed two consecutive weeks, or three consecutive weeks, or four or more consecutive mm-hmm. weeks. And it's not that hard to do. You have to set up some counters and some things mm-hmm. and keep track of stuff. And then it also printed out everybody that was a shut-in
mm-hmm.
or was away at college or away in the military. So just to keep track of people that maybe they need cards or they need visits or some other kind of thing. And it seemed to me like it would be useful to, they had the requirement if they write a program a report for you that they can offer it to anybody,
mm-hmm.
which is fair, you know. So I offered it to anybody.
So does Linux have any place in your whole setup?
Well, you know, I've got that network attached storage,
mm-hmm.
and but that's running on cloud, and that's right. That's got Debian on it.
Right. That was kind of a trick to get that set up, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a real pain.
It's a QNAP. What?
QNAP TS209.
Uh huh.
And the newer ones, I think, are easier to do. It's got an ARM processor.
Mm-hmm.
And but we got it to work. And you did it. You did most of it.
Well, that was the own cloud part. But you installed the Debian yourself, didn't you?
Yeah.
You had to SSH into it or something, and then
yeah. You still have to do that.
It was a bit of a trick because it doesn't have an output for a monitor. You can't.
No, there's no monitor at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would like to do more Linux. In fact, I would like to translate that program that I wrote. I'd like to translate all my programs into running them on Linux and Mac.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the people get a choice of what platform they want. And Mono has got a little bit more available in that area. And I saw an advertisement for an application or a addition for Microsoft Studio that would allow you to compile, use the Microsoft Studio IDE, would be able to compile for Mac or for Linux.
Nice.
And if I get a little bit better at it, I've got to be better enough for me to be willing to break out the wallet. And if I don't think I'm going to do it, I'm not going to pay for it. You see?
Are there no free tools that will allow you to do this without too much trouble?
Mono has some free tools that let you do it, but their IDE is not nearly as good as Microsoft Studio. Mm. And to be able to be running it in what you normally do, and just go up and click a button and say, compile this for a Mac, and it says okay and compiles it for a Mac, is worth something.
It's pretty handy. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if there's a huge amount of translation you have to do from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to learn more about programming for Android. I've got an app that I did for the Coffee County Industrial Board that calculates our return on investment when we offer incentives for companies to expand or to build, mm-hmm. you know, come in. And I really would like to rewrite it so it would run on an Android tablet.
Mm-hmm.
I've got an Asus tablet, and maybe I should have bought a Windows tablet. Then I would be able to do that almost immediately. But
no, you did the right thing, Dad.
if I rewrote it in something for Android, you see, then you know, you carry it around on a tablet PC instead of a regular PC.
Mm-hmm.
See, that would just be a fun thing to do, but I don't know.
I actually downloaded the Android SDK at some point and tried to do. It seems like I wanted to do something that would download a certain podcast, and I didn't get very far. It was really foreign to me, but I'd never done any kind of development in my life. I have no training in it. So.
Yeah,
and but you would probably do better at it than I would.
Well, I've done a little bit with. I wrote a couple of little simple programs with Android. What I'd like to be able to do is write a program that would allow me to have a SQL Server database that I can synchronize with an Android device.
Okay.
Sort of like CalDAV does.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't even know if there's any kind of interface at all that you can get into a SQL Server database and do it. But I haven't worked hard on it. This year's district governor has kept me pretty busy.
Yeah.
And so I haven't been able to do any woodworking even. You know, it's serious when you can't get out of your shop.
Exactly. Yeah, my dad has an excellent workshop out in a detached garage. All kinds of amazing tools. Made me a really nice bicycle wheel truing stand in the span of about an hour or two one day.
Wow, it took me more than that.
Okay, well, thanks, Dad. Appreciate that.
It took me a lot more than that.
But it's beautiful. Well, I appreciate you talking to me about all this, Dad. I'm hoping the HPR listeners will find it interesting.
I'm surprised that anyone would find any of it interesting. Yeah.
Well, the audience is a bunch of nerds.
Yeah, so, well, they're very, very forgiving then.
Yeah. Well, I've had a number of them when I was doing my own podcasts about shell scripting and things. I was like, you know, I don't really feel like I should read through this script. I mean, people would find it so boring. And then somebody emailed me and said, oh, no, I love hearing people read through scripts.
Well, you know, if you can find one thing that saves you some time or helps you do a problem you've not been able to figure out, it's worth it.
Yes.
I'll give a crass commercialism here, you know, commercial.
Mm-hmm.
I still maintain my Experts Exchange membership because, and I'm sure that there's scripting. They have almost anything you can imagine on Experts Exchange. And you put in a problem, And usually within 45 minutes, somebody has made a suggestion on how to fix it. Hmm. And it saved me so much time.
For me, it's either the forums or my StatusNet timeline. There's always, almost always somebody who can respond with something.
They've been through it already, and they either have found that you can't do it or they have found a way to do it.
Either way, it saves you time.
That's right. Either way, it saves you time.
All right. Well, thanks, Tim. Good talking to you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to turn it off now.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.